There we go. All right. Great to have everybody here today. It's going to be a wonderful day. Do I have anybody to move the minutes from February 26? Representative Zlesnikar, looks like you want to move the minutes. Representative Zlesnikar moves the minutes from February 26, 2025. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Now, the moment we've all been waiting for, House File 1. Representative Patty Anderson saunters up. There we go. Oh, I was hoping she'd pick the right chair.
We used to do music in this
community. Well, yeah, that is, yes. There she is. Great to see you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming before our committee. Feel free to get started and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Chair West and members.
I will move House File 1 to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Now, to your bill.
Thank you, Representative West. And I was told about 5 minutes ago when I got here that this is the best committee, according to Representative West. So we'll see if that's...
Good start.
We'll see if that's true. So, thank you. And I will give a brief overview. I know many of you have heard this bill already, and I can kind of tell you where we're at and so on. But House File 1 is a bill that establishes an independent office of Inspector General within the legislative branch. It would be overseen essentially by the Legislative Audit Commission, sitting parallel to the Legislative Auditor's Office, which, as you all know, is a legislative entity that answers to us as legislators. That Legislative Audit Commission is made up of 12 members, three from each of the four caucuses, and as I've been lucky to serve as a member on that for the last couple of years, and it's an extremely nonpartisan, good government entity. And I think that's really, really important as we talk about all the fraud that we've seen recently, and we want to make sure that the OIG's office is absolutely not political. They need to be non-political, and they need to be nonpartisan, and they need to be completely independent so they're able to do their job as an independent entity. And I think all of us agree on that. Their job would be to investigate and combat fraud, misuse. I call it misuse rather than waste and abuse because misuse is a little more definable than waste. And other public funds and state government, and to provide a better oversight of state grant making. The bill abolishes some of the existing legislative branch duties. There are six or seven state agencies that have OIGs currently within them. Some do very little, and some have a very large staff. And so there's some discussion about that in the bill, and it's been we've been working with the agencies to discuss what positions really should stay within the agency that may be under an org chart currently of an OIG, like at Human Services, and what should really come out because they're really more OIG related. It also develops and creates a fraud reporting hotline, conducts investigations, and reports suspected fraud to our law enforcement partners, whether it's counties, the feds, just our law enforcement partners. So I think it's probably best if I stop at this point and take questions from any of the members. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Before we do questions, we're going to run through the testifiers on the list, of which there is one. Mr. Bruce, Director of Legislative and Political Affairs at the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. Thank you for joining us today.
Welcome back.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and apologies to Representative Anderson. I know she was looking forward to not having me testify since I was absent in judiciary, but I was being specifically mindful over committee jurisdiction around our concerns. For the record, my name is Devin Bruce. I'm the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, MAPE. We are a union of over 18,500 members across all agencies, board, and commissions, including the OIG staff who are housed within the agencies of MDE, DCYF, DHS, as well as others. So first, I would like to thank Representative Anderson for adopting some of the and addressing some of the concerns we had around classification versus unclassified service. That's a big help. However, we still have numerous concerns around the bill, specifically the transfer of employees from the executive branch to the legislative branch. Under this proposal, it would strip them of their collective bargaining rights, as current legislative employees are exempted from 179A, otherwise known as PALRA. We believe that all workers deserve to have the right to collectively bargain and negotiate fair terms and conditions of their employment, and we strongly recommend that we add those provisions, or we can certainly help you to apply 179A to legislative branch employees. Second, this proposal to consolidate many of the OIG functions across the enterprise will do little to assist in the prevention and or identification of fraud. This bill does not strengthen or expand the licensing requirements or certification on recipients or applicants for some of these programs, nor does it expand the number of entities that need to comply with the background studies. It would also lead to further siloing between the departments, which is a strong concern, particularly when you're talking not just between executive branch agencies, but between the legislative branch and the executive branch. There's also a minimalization of the fact that fraud is a crime, and this generally requires a rigorous and often lengthy multi-departmental assessment to ensure that a lot of the recipients who are receiving public funding, especially in the Medicaid and other entitlement programs, are afforded due process. There is a fundamental presumption of innocence when bringing forth allegations of crime, and this bill does to some extent acknowledge that fact, that entities who are entitled to funding, even if there's a suspicion of fraud, that they cannot shut off funding. We saw this fact play out during the Feeding Our Future case, where MDE actually did try to identify and stop payment, only to be overturned by the courts and ordered to resume payments despite credible allegations of fraud. We are also seeing this play out currently in the New Way case, where they are alleging that they are entitled to the payments and that an open criminal investigation has not been initiated yet. So as this bill moves forward, we hope that that the legislature, particularly some of the other committees, provide substantial funding, not only for the agencies, but also to the BCA and to the Attorney General's office to help process and this backlog of cases so that they can assess whether there is credible evidence, not just a reasonable suspicion of fraud. Finally, I wanted to flag some of the potential concerns raised by other employee groups regarding the mandatory unannounced monitoring inspections here in the bill. Many of home care, PCAs, long-term and disability service providers are individuals receiving Medicaid to care for their family members or loved ones within their own homes. Not only would this be very uncomfortable for the investigators to show up unannounced, but it would also raise concerns around Fourth Amendment protections around unreasonable search and seizure. So we would hope that going forward that you provide the adequate resources and adequate guidance and ensure that the employees who are represented currently by collective bargaining agreements maintain that and placing it solely within the executive branch and not oversight by the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce, for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify on House File 1? Anybody else? All right, with that, I will close public testimony. Do you have any comments before we begin with member questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Chairman West. Let me just Let me talk about the classified versus unclassified. So in the bill, this is essentially set up exactly like the legislative auditor's office. Exactly. We mimicked it. There are the top deputies within the legislative audit are unclassified. Everyone else is in the classified service in that office. So it's set up exactly the same. They are not members of MAPE, though, and that's why he's here again. So, and it's great to see you again. I just want to clarify that so that folks understand that. And it's done for a reason, because there needs to be absolute, it works in the legislative auditor's office. There's been no issues whatsoever, and there needs to be absolute independence for that agency to function like we want it to do. So I'll mention that. I wanted to briefly touch on the siloing issue. The purpose of consolidating is because right now the agencies don't talk to each other, and the OIGs don't talk to each other, and some of the agencies don't even have people in the positions right now. They're empty. And by consolidating this into one OIG that oversees all, not just agencies, but the general purpose is what I call vendors. So they're looking at entities, whether they're businesses, nonprofits, individuals in some cases, who actually receive state dollars. So they can be grant dollars, it can be vendors, it can be program funds. And that's where we've seen the fraud in Minnesota. Hundreds of millions of dollars in fraud. And there are vendors. So the oversight generally is over the vendors here in Minnesota. So, and I will, I know there's probably lots of questions, and I want to be able to answer those. So, one other thing to mention, we have been working, this is a bipartisan bill. We've been working with the Senate. We actually have Senator Gustafson and a whole crew over there. We have meetings every Tuesday night at 5 o'clock, and there are members of all four parties here in the House. Representative Clyburn, Ginny, and Representative Norris have been at all of our meetings and providing great input. And we've also had some great input from some of the chairs of the other committees, whether it's on data practices issues, whether it's on both sides, the chair and the leads, whether it's with the ed finance, they've got some ideas that they want to throw out. And this is a bill that we need. We need to pass this. We need to do it bipartisan, that we're all comfortable, so that we can avoid what's been happening over the last 5, 6, 7 years here in the state of Minnesota in the future.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Mm-hmm. We will now go to member questions. Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Bruce, a question for you. One of the concerns you had was the collective bargaining with those in the executive branch, bringing over to the legislative branch. Is that something that can be negotiated with and or come to an agreement that you can also have collective bargaining with those same group of folks once they're moved over to the legislative branch?
Mr. Bruce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. We would certainly love to work on that bill with you. However, under Chapter 179A, there's specific definitions of who is considered a public employee and who is considered a public employer. The legislature is currently exempted from that statute.
Mm-hmm. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Bruce, we'll work on that piece of legislation then.
I'll be your co-author.
You'll be my co-author?
Absolutely.
Representative?
Okay.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thanks. I have kind of a couple questions kind of all related to the same thing. Is that okay? Okay. So you are looking at consolidating multiple OIGs into one OIG. Is that one OIG going to have criminal prosecuting authority?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative
Hemmingson-Yeager.
Yeager, I know the last part, yeah. Thank you. The OIG will not have prosecuting authority, but they will have law enforcement abilities. Does that make sense? So, but they will not be the prosecuting entity. It would be whether it's the county, they'd be referred to the counties, the feds, or the attorney general.
Okay.
Representative Hemmings-Yeager.
Thank you. So that seems kind of similar to what we've heard with DCYF and DHS giving their overview of their functionalities with their OIG. They have administrative authority, investigatory mm-hmm. authority, mm-hmm. but then they give that prosecuting authority to the local law enforcement mm-hmm. in the BCA. So I will ask you the same question. When these referrals are made to local law enforcement in the BCA, what is the rate with which those local law enforcement in BCA are resolving these cases?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I don't know the answer to that question, and maybe the agencies could answer individually.
Would you like somebody to come up and address that, Representative?
If they have the information, otherwise I can hear back.
Okay. They're shaking their heads. Okay. Representative Hemmings-Yeager.
All right. Okay, so, and now recently, very early in the session, the governor actually made an executive order to move many fraud functions, specifically with commerce, over to the BCA. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering how this bill will impact or interfere with that move.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Chairman DeWes. So my understanding is that the fraud unit at DEED was moved in with the BCA. The fraud unit DEED, by statute, is required to spend 70% of their time on insurance fraud. They are generally insurance fraud at DEED. They were moved in with the BCA, which is generally criminal. They investigate murders and bad things, you know, those sort of things. Very unrelated entities. And there's a lot of, I don't know if you're, who serves on commerce here, but there's a lot of huge concern by those entities and the employees that it not only made no sense, it doesn't function, and it certainly won't do anything to deal with the new fraud, I mean, this sort of fraud that an OIG oversees. This is not insurance. You know, you took an insurance fraud unit that's funded by insurance dollars and is statutorily required to spend 70% of their time on insurance fraud, and put them in with people looking at murders. And so I don't want to be too speculative about, I mean, it's opinionated about that move that the governor made, but it does nothing to combat any of the fraud that we've seen. And in fact, it's very controversial, and I suspect it will be moved back. So.
That is, as a member who sits on commerce, we spent a lot of time on that particular subject because mm-hmm. Their job is to do insurance fraud investigations, which leads to lower insurance rates, and having them moved over, well, we like the focus on fraud. That is something that we're trying to deal with over on the Commerce Committee.
Yeah.
But very good question, Representative Hemmings-Yeager.
Thank you. So since you kind of mentioned that, I am aware and I do know that the BCA does have a financial unit where they do deal with white-collar financial crimes, and financial fraud is a part of that unit. Mm-hmm. But so we mentioned that part of fraud. We mentioned deed fraud. I do also know, my understanding is that according to be federally compliant with CMS, the Medicaid agent, which has been dedicated to be DHS, mm-hmm. is like federally obligated to have an OIG. So I'm just a little concerned that in consolidating an OIG, we're actually just being redundant because we're going to have an overview OIG, DHS has to have an OIG, DEED deals with insurance fraud, and then we have our financial fraud unit over at the BCA. So I'm not sure how an overarching OIG is going to solve this problem.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Let me specifically answer the DHS issue. So we're working through, I don't believe they need to have an OIG, they have to have those functions, so as they're related to. But we're working through that, and we will make sure that you know, we're not duplicating any services. There are many things that the agencies do, the agency staff do, to look at, you know, fraud. Everything from minor things like making sure the Social Security numbers are right, you know, with people applying for X, Y, Z. So there are many things that really belong still within the agency that don't rise to the level of an OIG. A typical statewide OIG is, you know, under 100 employees. And they're heavy investigatory law enforcement. related. So.
Representative Hemmings-Yeager.
Not really a question right now, but just kind of a comment. So you mentioned that statewide OIGs have less than 100 employees. The DHS OIG has less than 100 employees, and they're managing $13 billion right now. So my concern is that because each agency has a specific jurisdiction, has specific statutory authority, that a statewide OIG is not really going to solve those problems, because we need to give statutory authority for agencies to talk, and that's part of the problem with the siloing is the agencies don't have statutory authority to talk back and forth, and a lot of that is in Chapter 13 with privacy concerns. So I'm just really concerned that we're taking specialists who know how to investigate, who have great relationships with federal and AG partners, and we're, I mean, there's always the question of what's going to happen to those employees, but that's for someone else to ask. Like, we're going to now make this general broad, and I'm concerned that we're going to have even more fraud falling through the cracks and not getting addressed. So it's my last few comments.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you. So I believe the org charts at DHS, there's like 400 people that sit under the OIG at DHS. And maybe the, is anyone here from DHS?
And the cavalry is coming up. They fixed the chair or something.
Chair West.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Elise Bailey. I'm the budget director at the Department of Human Services. Representative Anderson is correct in that our whole Office of Inspector General has about 487 employees. However, if we're just talking about our program integrity oversight unit, it's 99 employees. So Representative Hemmings-Yeager is also correct in that regard.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for bringing this forward. Just following up with Representative Hemmings-Yeager's comments, you know, saying she's concerned there could be more fraud. Have you looked at other states and seen, you know, what they're doing in other states? Is this, is your plan, you know, does that resemble something that you've seen somewhere else that has worked there?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf and Chairman West. We have looked at many, many states. We've met with the inspector generals cross country. We have met with the Associate of Inspector Generals. Every state does things differently. One thing that seems to work extremely well is by consolidating, they can actually one person has all the information. They can actually talk to each other. And so if there's fraud in Agency X, they know about it, and they're also watching that for Agency Y. They know about it. I can tell you that no state is even close to the amount of fraud that we've seen in Minnesota, not even close. Clearly, what we've been doing hasn't worked.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. And so my understanding is, you know, the Feeding Our Future fraud, what we just recently saw in the daycare fraud in Minnesota, both of those were federal investigations. And my question to you is, has Minnesota, the state attorney general, within our state government, have we investigated ourselves? You know, we're seeing federal investigations. Has the state of Minnesota themselves started investigations?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative West and Altendorf. There are so many different fraud things going on in Minnesota that it's been a mix. You're seeing the big ones, and they are federal right now. Now, a lot of that was federal dollars. So Feeding Our Future, some of the CCAP, a lot of these things are federal. It's Medicaid. It's federal pass-through money that was passed out through the states. And the state's job is to manage those funds and oversee them, okay, which didn't happen, obviously. So the feds ended up coming in and doing the prosecution. It could have been done, like in Feed Our Future, could have been done by the state too, but it ended up going to the feds. But there is a lot going on besides the things that you're seeing in the news right now.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Representative Anderson, just moving forward, what is the path of your bill? This is the second time I've seen you in committees. And what is the path that you're taking this bill?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Alfendorf. I think we've been through six committees. We will be going back through others. What's been different about this is that we are trying to work with the Senate, and so we've actually been amending our bills, both this Senate file and this House file, to make them more alike. As we come to agreement on different provisions, and we're pretty much there, or we're going to be there, I think, after tonight. But we've been trying to get the two bills so that everybody's on the same page, everybody agrees, and everyone sees it here at the legislature. So right now, what's the next path? I'm going to be back in State Gov on Thursday, and we'll see what happens after that. So,
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess maybe it's in my packet. I don't know. Do you have Democrats? Do you have bipartisan support signed on your bill right now?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I'm not sure. I didn't as of last week. They weren't actually signed on, but they will, they say. So.
Representative Altendorf.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So then on the Senate side, does it have bipartisan support on the Senate side?
Thank you, Representative Altendorf. Yes, it does. It's a bipartisan bill on the Senate side.
Representative Altendorf.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I guess just to finish this up, I appreciate all of your answers. And, you know, everyone in Minnesota knows right now that we have an incredible amount of fraud that has happened under the Walz administration. We also have had pretty much complete Democrat control. And this needs to be bipartisan support. Mm-hmm. I commend you for taking this through all these different committees, and this should be supported bipartisan. We absolutely, this is embarrassing mm-hmm. to the state of Minnesota to see the amount of fraud that is happening in the state. And I would just challenge everyone to please work with Representative Anderson. If there is some issue that this is not getting bipartisan support in the House, whatever that might be, we need to get there. We need to get to be, as a state, both parties, to say that we are going to look at this, we're going to investigate it, we're not going to allow this to happen under our watch anymore. We have tax dollars that are being wasted. No government agency, no business should accept that dollars are coming in the front door and going out the back door. And so, again, I thank you and just really, really thank you for working on this. I know you're putting a lot of time into this, and this should be a number one priority for every person in the whole state legislature right now. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And I just thought about we have invited anyone who wants to join us to come to our meetings to provide input. And many people on the other side of the aisle from me are at our meetings, and they've been joining us, and they're working on this. And this has to get done. It has to be bipartisan, but it has to work. We cannot create something that is just something in name only. This has to function. And for the long term, and it has to be independent. And so I ask anyone who has any interest in helping us make this bill work for all of us to come 5:00 tonight, walk over with me to the Senate. So thank you.
We appreciate that very much, Representative Anderson. This committee likes to be bipartisan, so I think it's admirable that you're making that part of your meetings. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson. It looks a lot different from the last time mm-hmm. I saw it. Yeah. So I have a couple of just clarifying questions, and I'm hoping you can answer. I see that some of the Medicaid DHS stuff has moved mm-hmm. And is not going to go.
Right.
So does that save us our federal match dollars then? Are we confident that we'll get to keep our federal match dollars since we're not moving these things? Because that's my biggest concern. I don't want to lose $97 million in federal match. Yeah. So I really want to make sure that this will fix that concern.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Can I ask Colby or someone to come up? And did you hear? Maybe give us Representative Hicks kind of a status of where we're at on that, because you know, yeah,
and
that's our goal too. And I appreciate those of you in that committee to work with us on some of this. So,
Representative Anderson, I assume the goal is to ensure that is not like that. Representative Hicks' concerns are addressed before this bill becomes law.
Right.
Actually, I don't know your name. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, the language that Representative Anderson is referring to with the exceptions for the Department of Human Services can be found on page 18 of the fourth engrossment, starting on 18.22 and continuing through the bottom of that page. So these are the divisions and teams within DHS that would not transfer to the OIG. My understanding is that these are programs that federal regulations or law requires an in-house investigatory team to look into alleged fraud. But I, you know, I would defer to DHS as to whether this covers everything they feel should be left within the agency to retain federal funds.
Representative Anderson, or
And Representative Hicks, as we keep working on this, which is the goal, because it needs to be perfect. Okay, we will. We will absolutely make sure that that's the case. Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I really do appreciate that. And I know that your intention is there, and I really support that. I'm just really nervous because I've asked this question a couple of times, and we can't seem to really get an answer. And so I feel like, and I know you have more committee stops, and I know you're making like ongoing changes, but before this is complete, we really need to be like 100% sure that we're not leaving federal money on the table. And I still haven't really been able to get that answer. I've asked you in committee, I've asked other folks offline, and I'm like really worried about it because it's a lot of money. And so this is my kind of plea that if we could, before this moves to Ways and Means, if you could send whoever's ever interested, but particularly me, whatever documentation you have that guarantees that, I would really appreciate it because I'm very, very concerned. Having worked in Medicaid policy for a long time, I know how stringent those things are, and I'm really worried about it. So I do appreciate you, the work you've done here. I really appreciate what you continue to bring, but just like I don't want to leave any money on the table.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I will. Thank you.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for being here. And I feel like it feels like every bill that goes through like every committee, I almost never really have a crack at it. I remember when we were talking about cannabis, Representative Stevenson asked us if anyone hadn't heard the bill in committee, and I was the only one. So I'm glad to finally get this bill. So just a few questions here. And as I'm looking at, in particular, Article 1, Section 9, details the powers of the offices, the Office of OIG. And it lists a number of things, subpoena witnesses and so on, recommend temporary sanctions, and so on and so on. I won't list everything off here. But what I'm not seeing, and, it, you know, the language of the bill says that, you know, that fraud, misuse, and other unlawful uses must be prevented. What I'm not seeing, I mean, all of this is seems to me is investigation. And so my question is, if the goal is to prevent fraud, how does this do that?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Coulter. So an OIG is an investigatory entity, I think, talking to many other OIGs, they would argue very much that they're just by virtue of what they're doing, they have stopped a huge amount of fraud across the nation. And they've given us different examples of how that's happened. I think you're probably talking about upfront, you know, things that like Department of Admin. As you know, we've expanded their grant, you know, they have a grants management entity now, right? So, and they're sort of getting their footing. It's relatively new, well, newly expanded. So they went from 3 people to, I think there's 9, and they can go up to 12. But they're actually setting up things within the administrative branch or the executive branch to help agencies. So it's like a checklist. Do this, do this, do this. It's this. Those are things that are sort of happening and should be going on within the administrative branch. You should be checking these things. You should be making sure that entities have grants, have an I-9, that the registers, you know, these kind of things. So I think that's a big part. But it's also, frankly, a lot of this is when there's whistleblowers, so when people are questioning some of the dollars going out or whether the services that we're paying for, right, as taxpayers and as legislators, there are programs that we created that we want to have occur, and we're paying someone to do that, whether that's an NGO or whether that's a hospital or whatever. We need to, if someone says, hey, you know, maybe there's not meals getting served, like 5,000 meals a day at this little 1,000 square foot restaurant, you know, we need to actually be on that right away. And I'm on the fraud committee. I'm also on the Legislative Audit Commission, and for some reason, it seems to be my specialty here now in the legislature is all this stuff, maybe my background. But there are lots and lots of whistleblowing that was going on during all this, and it was generally ignored, you know, and that's what we're getting from folks. And we can't do that either. We have to investigate things when people say there's something wrong, and we've got to do it on the front end. Part of the bill talks about unannounced site visits. So, you know, if we would just do unannounced visits, we would have caught a lot of this stuff. And those dollars that went to fraudsters could have gone to people who actually needed the services where they were supposed to go. So.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm not hearing is really sort of, you know, how we're being sort of proactive in preventing that. But I think to the point that Representative Hemmingson-Yeager was making as well. I mean, I agree. Obviously, investigations are really critical pieces of this. It's still not clear to me why this particular setup is a better arrangement than simply empowering the existing OIGs, and, you know, in our case in particular, within DCYF, who have much more expertise, who are more familiar with the players involved. And in particular, I do want to raise up, Representative Hicks brought up Medicaid dollars. I also want to raise up the federal dollars that we received through the Child Care Development Fund. Mm-hmm. And I would just really implore you to, frankly, make the same commitment that you did just now to Representative Hicks, that we are not going to put any of those dollars at risk, because we know that tens of thousands of families in Minnesota depend on that funding for affordable child care. And I know I can tell you, because I've heard, when you're a parent of young kids, you hear from other parents of young kids, and I've heard from providers who are really already deeply worried with any potential cuts that may come down from the federal level. And so I think we need to be sort of very careful about ensuring that we do not lose out on any of those dollars. And so I am actually going to ask you if you're willing to make that same commitment with regards to the Child Care Development Fund.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And Representative, I am willing to make that commitment, and I have in other committees. We will not, there will be nothing in this bill to lose $1 of federal funding. I am if anything, I'm a huge fiscal hawk, and I want to make sure that we're not losing a dime, and that this isn't, not only is this not costing us money, in fact, I think there'll be the way this is structured with the grant, you know, using some of the grant dollars, just like they do within the agencies, I think there'll be almost no cost to the general fund on this, but we absolutely will not lose a dollar of federal money.
And Chair Katisa Batuun and I both sit on Ways and Means, so we do have a crack at it to ensure if we find out something needs to be done, we are there to pay attention to it. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one last, and first of all, thank you for making that commitment. I really do appreciate that. One last question, though. You actually just referenced the unannounced site visits, and I am actually going to go back to the page that was just referenced. It was page 18, line 25, specifically references that the licensing division within DHS would be exempt from this. And actually, another question just comes to mind about how that works with the transfer to DCYF, but we can get into that later since that was not my original question. But so if this bill were to become law, then we would have licensors either from DHS or from the county, as well as folks from OIG potentially making unannounced visits at these at child care centers, family child care centers, and other centers as well. Am I correct in understanding that?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Representative Coulter, my intent is not to duplicate what's being done, so I'll have to. Can you point out the lines again that are?
So this is yeah. Page. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Coulter.
Yeah. Page 18, line 25. It provides an exception for the Department of Human Services with regards to the licensing division. And so what I don't know that this would necessarily even be duplicative.
Yeah.
Because it would just mean that there would be even more unannounced site visits, in this case, both from licensors and potentially from folks with this Office of the Inspector General. Am I just correct in understanding that?
Right.
To clarify that there would just be more potentially unannounced visits from whoever is hired to do this job.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Coulter. 18.5. This is that section is it's an exception that those positions are not transferring to the OIG. So I just want to.
Yeah. No. I.
Representative Coulter.
Sorry. Yeah. Maybe it's better we take this offline.
Yeah. Let's do that.
Yeah. So I'll catch you later. Yeah. Thank you.
Guys are out of control.
All right.
All right. Representative Sensimura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think Representative Coulter, covered some of the things that I wanted to ask about. I'm wondering, Representative Anderson, if you can react a little bit to the management and budget memo that we got. Mm-hmm. I think the question was asked, why are, what is kind of maybe DFL members' hesitancy in, like, really getting behind this bill, right? And I think one of the things that I think we've brought up at different committee stops. I was at Education Finance where you brought it, what would we potentially lose by taking these already established inspector generals that are within departments that maybe have very specific or nuanced duties that they are doing and moving them to one place? And I think one of the things that we've talked about is, loss of federal funding. We're seeing this memo from management of budget that says, and I'll just read it, shifting specific functions to a separate entity could risk putting the state out of compliance with federal regulations. That worries me. So I'm wondering, can you speak a little bit to that? And I think more generally, can you speak to some of these specific concerns around what would this position look like within DCYF, whether it's, which divisions are going to go over from there, which divisions are maybe going to stay separate, like the lines that Representative Coulter was just talking about. I think I also have questions about the site visit piece of it, right? There's a, there's a portion in here that talks about grants. Like, what is considered, a grant within DCYF that might get a site visit? If I could just hear you speak a little bit more about some DCYF specific functions.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. The Inspector General is my understanding. I've talked to someone's here actually that I talked to recently, but they just hired the position, and they actually haven't laid out most of this yet. So it's evolving. So I don't know about what would stay and what would go, because I don't even think it exists right now within the new agency.
Representative Sensimura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess when we're seeing like 18, maybe this is a question for nonpartisan, when we're seeing 18.25, what kind of licensing is that referring to?
Ms. Sunderman?
Mr. Chair and members, on 18.25, it's, as this is drafted, it is all human, all DHS licensing, which at this moment includes programs that will be licensed by DCYF once once the responsibilities transfer on July 1 of this year. That's my understanding. Yes.
Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you. So from what I'm understanding then, the licensing would be separate from the Inspector General. And so are we then anticipating that there would be separate site visits for licensing, separate site visits for Inspector General, maybe doing some of the site visits that are talked about in here? I think my worry about that, right, is at a time where we're hearing from child care centers across the state that, like, the burdens and regulations we're putting on them are sometimes too much. Are we looking at maybe 5 site visits a year for a child care center? And could we combine some of the licensing visits with whatever kind of site visit monitoring we might need to do for the Inspector General?
Mm-hmm. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. It's important that as we create the Office of Inspector General, whether that would have been within an agency or you know, the statewide, that we give those, the new Inspector General, whoever that is, a year from now, whenever that person's hired, and their staff, the ability to make some of those decisions themselves. It doesn't make, I don't think an Inspector General is going to think it's worthwhile to have staff going to every single daycare center when they're already having site visits that are occurring now. And that's not of the level, should we say, that they should be doing, the level of work that they should be doing. But the fact is that there were not site visits unannounced happening in Minnesota. And that's what has created a lot of the problems that we've all been seeing, a lot of the fraud that we've been seeing.
I have a really quick question for nonpartisan on the same line. On 12.12, it talks about the unannounced monitoring on grants. Is that specifically like a named grant? Would, like, for this purposes of this committee, would that include CCAP, a site that gets, you know, $250,000 in CCAP money? Would that also qualify as a grant, or is that separate? Mr. Sullivan.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, so the language that you're referring to on page 12, these are grants management policies administered by the Department of Administration and the executive branch for any state agency that's issuing grants. So are CCAP payments to a child care provider considered grants by the administration, by the executive branch? I don't know that. I think it would be good to hear from the agency on that. I would just note, too, the unannounced monitoring visits required on 12.12 to an earlier question from Representative Sensenmura. It wouldn't be the Inspector General who would perform the monitoring visits. It would be the agency administering the grant that has a contractual relationship with the grantee. So that could be the Department of Human Services, the Department of Natural Resources, any state agency that awards a grant.
Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chairman, I stand to be corrected by the department, but I believe not in this case, because each one is an individual aid to a family, not a collective amount to the center. So I think the answer would be no, but I will check with the department.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Burke. Sorry for interrupting, Representative Sensenmura. Go ahead.
No, thank you. I mean, I think that was kind of my question, right? And I think what... maybe could we get the department to come up and offer some guidance around that? I think it would be helpful to understand if this bill is adding additional powers that could specifically, you know, get at some of the issues that we are seeing in child care centers.
Isn't it fun for a committee to be productive? Thank you for coming before the committee. Please introduce yourself and answer the question.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members. I am Jennifer Sommerfeld from the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And there have been a few questions, so can you clarify which question or which line in the bill for me?
Mm-hmm. Representative Sensabura.
Yes, thank you. So 12, it's 12.12.
And am I correct? Your question was, are we going to have expanded authorities for grants? Some of that impacts
CCAP? Yeah, so thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, this is a lot of language around grants management. I think the question is, would CCAP be considered a grant, in which case there would be kind of these thresholds for if it's over 50,000, you're doing an annual visit, you're doing an unannounced visit for 250,000.
Ms. Sommerfeld.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so I think Mr. Berg was correct. Yeah. This is not a grant program. Child care assistance is a public assistance program. It's forecasted. I'll verify, and I'll let you all know if I'm somehow incorrect on that, but that is my understanding. Grants are managed differently than public assistance programs.
Representative Sensabura.
Thank you. That's helpful to understand. And so I guess, you know, knowing that, then my question to you, Representative Anderson, is, you know, what do you see this bill allowing an investigative inspector general to do, or specifically regarding child care centers and CCAP, you know, that we're not already doing?
Representative Anderson.
I don't know all the details of exactly what we're doing already, but in the inspector general, just like the legislative auditor, has full ability and full access to any program where there are dollars that have been spent. And if there's an allegation of fraud, they certainly would have the ability to investigate that, to go to a site visit, to have access to records, to have the immediate ability to do that.
Representative Sensabura.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think, you know, a comment for this committee, I think, to think about is, you know, we already know that our child care centers are getting multiple visits, so it seems like, you know, maybe what some of this bill is trying to get at is, you know, are we giving grants to entities and then never checking in on them? Mm-hmm. It seems like it might be a different issue in regards to child care, and so I wonder if, you know, there's more specific language that could be put in or more guidance maybe from this committee that could actually make this really applicable to some of the issues that we're seeing within this specific agency, within this specific program. Thank you.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, you know, with DCYF and the DHS split, it took 2 years, and I'm looking at the effective date being July 1st, 2025, and this needing a vote in May. And I'm just concerned about, do you think you have enough time to pull this off?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Perez-Vega. The effective date is July, but it's very specific that the actual things won't transfer until the new inspector general says they're ready for it. And I'd have to find... let's see. I guess it's the end. Section 14, or it's a 19. Section 8. The whole thing is that whole last section. It's when they notify the agency. Define the language. This is keeps it up. When they notify the agency that they're ready and they can assume responsibility. I can tell you this will take from July. It'll probably take 18 months. To complete is my guess.
Representative Perez-Vega.
So the effective date wouldn't be July 1st, 2025.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Perez-Vega. The effective date of the legislation is July, but then just like the effective date of when the split was done with Children and Families, I think was probably a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago. Whenever that legislation, but then the actual move and the transfer duties will take whatever time it happens to take.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I'm in my second term, so when I see effective date and mm-hmm. on the legislation that we passed last year, I mean, with driver's licenses for all. We had an effective date on that legislation that was stand and sturdy for October 1st of 2024. And that's when it started. That's when it happened and gave enough information on protection of data and budget. But I just, you know, I always stick to that's the effective date, that's the legislation, that's the goal, that's the strategy, that is the conscience of everybody working within these departments and the statutes. And then another question, Mr. Chair, if I can address to Representative Anderson, mm-hmm. is that, or I guess more of a concern, but if there is maybe some work being done, because we don't have a fiscal note. Mm-hmm. This has to be voted in May. It is stated that it's being effective July 1st of 2025 of this year, but there's not a fiscal note as of yet, and we're all waiting for this great FN coming soon. But, you know, what's the cost assumption for IT staff on this? What's the cost going to be? Because, you know, that... to get all of that data, it costs money. And I'm just trying to figure out here how we're going to all accumulate all this under this budget, short time, effective dates.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And maybe on the exact effective date, I can explain that further, or maybe I can have nonpartisan explain how this works when we transfer agency duties. And regarding the IT, I haven't thought about the IT, so thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Anderson is correct in how the effective dates work. So Section 12 provides for the transfer of duties between existing OIGs and the new Office of the Inspector General. And that section is per line 19.10. It is effective on July 1st of this year. But the language in subdivision 1 on lines 18.11 to 18.17 say that the duties and personnel do not transfer until, this is on 18.14, the Inspector General certifies in writing to the Commissioner of the respective department and the Commissioner of Management and Budget that the Inspector General has assumed responsibility for these duties. So that would be as soon as that's humanly possible, I guess, mm-hmm. for the OIG to staff up and assume those responsibilities.
Representative Perez Vega.
So there's, do we assume maybe a close range of what that would cost? Has anybody done the research on that?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Cost for which part?
The staffing.
Representative Perez Vega.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. As far as the IT staffing on that, I mean, the effective resources that are going to have to be implemented by workforce, folks that are going to be a part of this department. If that data is not going to be transferred through these departments, where's it coming from? Who's doing the work? How much does it cost?
I assume the fiscal note will address that when it's finally done, but Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I'll leave it at that, and that the fiscal note would address it. But I think the data exists now within.
But it's not being.
Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for not going through you. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, if this data, though, is not being transferred, am I correct, from these departments, or is it getting transferred? Like, it's basically you're restarting something new here. A whole department, when we have a department that took 2 years to get, and you mean to tell me that this is going to start in 2 months after May, after this session is done. Is that correct? No, but the effective date states July 1st. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know what? We could take it offline. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. I have a question because I don't know if everybody knows this, but you served in state government before and as a state auditor, and I was just curious, during that time, how much fraud did you guys catch? Did you catch any? I know it maybe wasn't just the auditor's office, obviously lots of different agencies working on that, but I'm just curious how much you caught, how did you do that, and how have you kind of injected that experience into this bill? I think that's really helpful for folks to know.
Republicans who've had statewide office do exist. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Unfortunately, it was a long time ago, though, so back when we did have more than half the statewide offices. I've served in two statewide positions. I did serve as a state auditor, and I also served as a commissioner. And ironically, I served as a, let me talk about that quick, because that goes a little bit to what, your question, but I served as a commissioner of a department called Employee Relations, which no longer exists, Department of Employee Relations. And that was in Plenty's second term, and there was legislation like this that was passed to essentially get rid of that that department, which I ran through the legislature and helped pass. And we merged that department into about four other departments. A lot of it's in M&B. That's sort of the one that M&B was gotten larger and created, someone into health, someone into human services, someone over to it was Dolly. That process from the time the legislation was effective in July of that year took about a year, about 10 months. In that time, to the gentleman from MAPE, no one was laid off. People were transferred. There were positions not filled. The only person laid off was myself and my assistant commissioners. So, and that was, I think, the only time ever in state government that that's been done. So I'm proud of that, actually. I also did serve as the state auditor. The state auditor is different than the legislative auditor, so they oversee local units of government. So their job is to, it's currently Auditor Blaha is the current state auditor. They oversee those issues within all local units of government, so everything from schools, counties, cities, to my council, and so on. There's a division that's still there that's a special investigations unit, and it's essentially staffed with accountants and attorneys, or at least was back then. So when there are tips, when people call in, or when there's anything going on that they hear about within local government, there's a team at the state auditor's office that investigates that. And if there is, in fact, fraud or mostly it's fraud, then that is sent to law enforcement. Usually it's the county attorneys because the local government, as you can imagine, is all over the state, right? So in every county. I don't know what's been happening recently since I left, but at the time, back then, it was a pretty active unit within state government. So does that answer your question? I do have lots.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. It's good insight. I think it's helpful information. I guess I was just kind of curious about during your time, obviously in a statewide position, we know you're part of an administration, right? Mm-hmm. And so my question is also getting at, during your time in the Pawlenty administration, how much fraud did you guys catch? And how are you injecting those lessons learned from your time in that administration into your time now in implementing this office? I'm just kind of curious how they're connected, if at all.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. So when I served as a commissioner, I did not oversee any kind of investigatory. I did oversee HR, and I dealt with a lot of HR problems in the state. So all private information. a lot of them. Interesting things. But I don't even remember about what may have happened. The big thing during the time of Plenty was when the bridge fell in Minneapolis. I mean, that was a big issue, in MnDOT. So, but I don't remember. It was a while ago.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that answer. I was just curious if you had brought any illustrious knowledge you could share with us today from how the Pawlenty administration caught fraud back in those days and if we could apply it today, because we hear a lot of the rhetoric, right, about this being a partisan issue, and so I'm one to always get curious about things and learn from people who came before me. I do a lot of work with a lot of the folks who've been in the legislature before me, and talking to them is really important to me. Mm-hmm. So that was the reason, just an institutionalist in me, just asking if there was any big tips we could apply to this bill. But I think the biggest thing that I want to kind of highlight there is that you know, when we learn things in state government, it's important to apply them, you know, whatever seats we're in, whether we're in statewide office or not. And so one of the things that you said, that came up earlier that really caught my attention was this ask about bipartisanship. Mm-hmm. And as a lot of you know, a large portion of the bills that I've worked on in this body have been bipartisan. I've grown government twice with Republicans. I like to brag about that. And I think it's important that we be honest about what it takes to have a bipartisan bill. Mm-hmm. And part of that, I think, is some good camaraderie and mutual respect. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what, you know, some of the rhetoric we heard a little bit ago is I think what does push people away from wanting to work on bipartisan things like this. I think when this, you know, this concept came up earlier, before session started, Democrats had suggested it and Republicans called it a political stunt. And so if we can try to mend some of those fences and talk about them and be really honest, I think we'll probably have more folks interested in joining up to be bipartisan on bills like that. My actual question for you, though, is if the fiscal note comes back at, let's say, just, I'm going to pick a number, tens of millions of dollars, let's just say, what are some of the things that you would support cutting, or how would you recommend we fund whatever that fiscal note might be, would be my question.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative Hansen. I have tried very, very hard to have this bill be bipartisan. Very hard. Thank you. And it will be. This will be something we'll all be very proud of and will pass overwhelmingly. That's the goal. It's the goal in the Senate. I'm working really hard with Senator Gustafson, who, as you know, is a Democrat. So, and the inside, she's the other. So if you think about the positions that are moving, first of all, they're currently funded, right? Okay, so you're moving positions. I can tell you when I did the Doer merger into the other departments, there was no cost. Or very little. Actually, that's not true. I think it was like $200,000 or something. But very little cost. We're taking, in many cases, existing positions or things that maybe are set to be filled but aren't. There are open positions within these OIGs, including OIG positions that exist now. They're not all filled in these agencies. So you're moving existing positions. There's also provision in here about the grant, the 1% in the grant. That alone is more than enough to fund this. I understand very much we could have ugly news on Thursday and that there are competing things. We all have things that we're looking for whether they're for our districts or for those that we serve or whether it's childcare, you know, whatever, you know. And so they're all going to compete. And so my goal is to make this not one of those things that's competing. Thanks.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that answer. I think it's important that as we're doing this like pre-fiscal note work that we at least have these conversations on the record for the public. I think that's an act of responsible government, so I appreciate your entertaining that idea. Like I said, I hope that if it's not a no cost, though. I may disagree with you a little bit on that because last year when we moved the Department of Children, Youth, and Families over, you know, that seemingly everybody was still there and it was just a division, but it still ends up costing money. And so I would hope that whatever ends up being kind of in the horse trade on this, being that it's a priority for folks, and I can understand that, that we just make sure that we are not leaving anybody behind. And I would just ask from your long time in public service and your long time seeing what different administrations have done over the many years here, that we really remember how many decades it can take when we make a cut somewhere in order to fund something else. And I feel like I'm preaching to the choir a bit on this. And so you've been doing this a lot longer than I have, but that would just be my ask is that we really make sure we don't leave kids behind. Our committee here is trying to fund a replacement of a very important critical system for our child protection system that's looking to cost about, you know, it's a lot of money, $100 million, and we're trying to scrape by every penny we can. And so just keeping that in mind that there are definitely needs for committees that some members don't serve on, and we hope that we don't get thrown out with the bathwater on some of those things. So thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Nadeau.
Mr. Chair, and, you know, thank you, Representative Anderson, for bringing this bill and the debate that's gone on today, and I've listened closely. I really appreciate the way that you've presented this bill, the openness in which you've made yourself and your committee, the effort that you've made to try to get people from the other side to come in and work on this with you. I don't know if I would have been as gracious, actually. We have a huge fraud problem in this state, and there's concerns that Representative Hicks brought up about it. You know, we got to make sure that we don't cause damages. And Hemmingson Yeager talking about, are there redundancies to be in here? And I appreciate the way that you've addressed those, and you're willing to work with people. And to Representative Hansen's comments, bipartisanship is a choice that we make every day on every issue. And I've seen you do it today, I've seen you do it in the past, and I've seen it permeated through this bill. And I just recommend the committee, I don't know how anybody isn't in favor of this. Are there issues in here? Is it a perfect bill? No. But Minnesota has a massive issue where, and it's caused by us. It's caused by the legislature. We basically dump boatloads of money into agencies, into the county, and we don't look at implementation in an effective way. We don't look at how we're evaluating these programs. We put it out there and say, DHS, you need to deliver these services. And then all of a sudden, something goes wrong. They don't have enough staff in order to deliver those services. They don't have enough oversight in order to evaluate those services. And then we find ourselves in a position where we've misused some dollars. And we've done it in a big way in Minnesota as of late. And I applaud you for the approach that you've taken with this. And I'm sorry that I've gone on, Mr. Chair, but I think that this is a... I think that as you continue through the committees, you're going to continue to make those changes. And I hope that at the end of the day, that there's 134 members that vote for this bill coming off the Minnesota House floor. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I might pontificate later, so don't worry about it. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm so sorry. I was a little distracted, and then I thought I got confused. So I just need to clarify. So we've already taken all of the Medicaid stuff out because we would lose our federal funds. So we won't be able to do Medicaid investigations of fraud with this, right? Because that's what those lines on 18 do. Those all stay at DHS.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. The OIG can investigate whatever they deem needs to be investigated. Okay. But those particular positions that are required, and I will absolutely confirm as this evolves. Okay, so, but they will continue to be done within DHS.
Okay, so Medicaid program integrity. So Medicaid integrity is going to stay at DHS. CCAP integrity will stay at DCYF once it fully moves to DCYF. So this would only do competitive and legislatively appropriated grants. That would be the primary focus.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. We haven't actually laid out the CCAP stuff, so I just want to clarify. So that section isn't here yet, and that's evolving. But certainly grants, much beyond that. I know that folks on this committee and DHS are very focused on, the things that they oversee, but there are many other things. Many other parts of government that have programs besides, some of the things that you just brought up and that go beyond grants. So to say that they're only going to the OIG will only be looking at grants is not accurate. It's much beyond that. I think there'll be a big chunk of it will be grants. There are $400 million. In grants every year that are given by this legislature. That's a huge amount of money.
And one of the roles of the Office of Inspector General is to evaluate current state programs to we're seeing fraud waste, but making sure that they are following the law as an agency. Representative Hicks.
Yes, thank you for that. Okay, so totally get that. Understand it's more than just grants. So for this agent or this committee, would it oversee SNAP?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Representative, I will be able to give you a better answer when I get into those. I don't know. I don't have an answer. I can tell you the OIG can look at anything. Who's going to be doing the very specific? So the OIG is not going to be running SNAP.
No.
Yeah.
Representative Hicks.
Okay. So here's where I'm confused.
Yeah.
So you're right. I'm kind of a one-trick pony. I'm very human services focused. Everybody sort of knows that. It's sort of my jam. So here's where I'm a little confused. Mm-hmm. Because right now, OIG at DHS does – so there's a couple of – there's SIRS and there's OIG, right? So site integrity, surveillance, they do Medicaid enrollment – they do site visits on Medicaid providers. If they see anything that like flags them, then they call DHS, Medicaid, OIG. They go in and do an audit, and then they call the Attorney General, and all the things happen, right? That's the general setup. With SNAP investigations, sort of a similar gig, right? If we think there's SNAP fraud by a provider, then it's you. Then it's usually a county attorney, but it's also like OIG, and those people are moving over to DCYF, and so like. That's like a different, very big program, right? And so, but that's not a grant. Mm-hmm. And when I've asked questions about some of these really big programs where, frankly, we have seen fraud, mm-hmm. they aren't coming for a variety of reasons, which make a lot of sense. But then I get back to like, so what are we doing? And I don't, mm-hmm. I am pro figuring out the fraud. Mm-hmm. I am here for that. Mm-hmm. But like right now, DHS employees can and do report to the OLA whenever there's a concern and mm-hmm. they do an investigation. Like that's already happening. So I can't figure out how all these different pieces come together, and I'm not anti this bill. I'm like very pro figuring out mm-hmm. like how to do a better job mm-hmm. of fraud management. I just can't figure out why, you know, like you said, the siloing. I agree. The state enterprise is ridiculously siloed. Mm-hmm. So why not just write a bill that gives them the directive that they must communicate and must share lists and must, right? Like how does this do that differently? Without, I don't get it.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And maybe this is a much more in-depth conversation. Maybe we can sit down together. We don't need a bill to let the agencies talk to each other. So, when we shouldn't have to make them do what they should be doing anyway. So, we don't need to make them do that. They should be doing it, period. And they're not. So, and we all know that. I guess I'd have to figure out exactly what question you want me to answer.
I do like the idea of making them share, because one of the biggest frustrations is when a department says they can't talk to somebody else for whatever reason, and it's like,
they can,
though. It drives me nuts. Mm-hmm. Good. Representative Hicks?
So I guess my like core question mm-hmm. is which specific programs mm-hmm. would this be the primary oversight function of? Because if Medicaid providers are not the primary function, mm-hmm. as is outlined in the exceptions, if CCAP providers, which are not mentioned, are not the primary function, mm-hmm. if SNAP, both individuals and businesses that are enrolled, are not the focus, mm-hmm. right? Then if it's just grants, which again, I understand mm-hmm. that's a lot of grants, mm-hmm. right? But why a whole new agency for just grants?
Representative
Hicks. Kind of wrap my head around.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hicks, we were told that you had one little
I'm
question.
I'm sorry.
Representative Anderson, do you want to respond to that? It's okay, we're just kind of teasing you, but.
Yeah, thank you. And I'll try to be brief. There are regulatory functions which are stay in the agency. So if you want to say who has primary oversight over those programs, it would be whatever agency they're in. In all cases, they would have the primary oversight. You're not going to take, you know, what is our budget, $70 billion? It's a huge budget. And have, you know, the 70 people at the OIG overseeing that. So it's... this primary function of overseeing any program would stay within the agency, whether that's public safety, whether that's, you know, whether that's the PUC, whatever that is, it would stay within the agency. So,
no,
how are we doing on time?
With this particularly representative. So, Representative Turbo Lightning.
terrible.
Representative Hemmingsen Yeager.
I got a reputation to keep. Okay. Are you familiar with Minnesota Statute 245.095?
What's it say?
Okay. It is titled The Limits on Receiving Public Funds. If you are looking at ways to get agencies to talk to each other a little bit more, I would recommend looking at that statute and seeing how you can strengthen that to help agencies communicate with one another.
Okay.
Absolutely lives up to the title and also very good point. Representative Sensenmura.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be quick. I think this is actually more of a question for you. So, you know, I think hearing that you're working on some of the maybe specific sections that have to do with this committee, like the CCAP and kind of how this would interact with some more programs at DCYF, I'm wondering if we can get a commitment from you that this bill will come back before the committee, just because I feel like there's a lot of unanswered questions specifically about our jurisdictions about this bill.
I cannot commit that to you, but I will say this committee has done exactly what I hoped in terms of making the bill, pointing out issues that might be in our particular area. This is a productive committee, I would say. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll come back, maybe it won't, but I cannot commit to that. Representative Sensenmura? No? Representative Anderson.
Can I say, most of the committees have been really productive. I mean, the judiciary, it was all about data privacy. You know, nobody's brought that up here. You know, so there's been different things because this is a big bill. This is a big, big bill. And again, we have to get this done right. So it's been really helpful to me and those folks that are working on this, and including nonpartisan staff who's done most of the drafting, including the Senate. We've taken some Senate sections already and we've put them in here. So it's been super, super helpful. And I really appreciate being able to have this dialogue with the committees. So.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that said, in the other committees and previously, there has been sections of bills that just pertain to that committee. Mm-hmm. In this bill, Mr. Chairman or nonpartisan staff, is there just sections that pertain to this committee, or is it the whole bill itself? That's all I have.
Mr. Sullivan, getting his steps in today. You're welcome to sit at the table, too.
Yeah, just stay.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, you know, there are references to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families in House File 1, the fourth engrossment, in the transfer section, section 12 on page 18, and in the embedding of OIG staff within, physically embedding within state agencies. The Department of Children, Youth, and Families is also mentioned there.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, I saw that. I mean, for example, the marijuana bill and in higher ed, we just talked about this much of a bigger bill. So I just wanted to see if that was the case. But from what you said, Mr. Sullivan, the whole thing is under this jurisdiction, even though it's mentioned in their children's and families. But the whole bill pertains to this committee. Is that correct?
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair. You know, I defer to the chair, really, and
Yeah. Yes, it does. This is, we can talk about, as it was abundantly clear in this conversation, in particularly because it eliminates, well, transfers, eliminates the OIG and the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. It's basically makes the whole bill relevant. All right. Chair Katizawa-Dune.
Yay, it's finally my turn. Everybody did a great job asking questions today, so I have more just closing comments, I guess, Representative Anderson, and I really appreciate you and your collaborative work with Representative Norris and Representative Cleavorn and the senators. I mean, I think that this is a really pressing issue. It's an urgent issue that we need to take action on this session, and it is going to take bipartisan support, and I think that we often reach our best legislation. There's never perfect legislation, but we've reached our best legislation when we are able to work together. So, I mean, I think it should go out without saying, but we agree, the Democrats agree that this is a problem and that public funds, particularly that we have allocated, should go to the people. And the House DFL strongly supports this action to combat fraud and ensure program integrity. To the extent that we've taken specific action here in this committee to prevent fraudulent actors within the child care assistance program, we know truly, and the chair and I were both on the committee in 2019 when we took that initial action, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, the people who are often best positioned to prevent and counteract fraud, particularly with child care providers, are the people on the front lines at DCYF. And I have some concerns about the cost and what this looks like and moving it forward without a fiscal note. But I know it's a really big bill, and I know that you have got a lot of other committee stops. But I think that, you know, if depending on what the final shift looks like potentially from DCYF with our internal OIG, this committee has had to fight tooth and nail for the funds that we needed to start up the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and enabled the department to ensure that the providers are well-trained and they're not making avoidable errors. And at this point, I really do want to clarify again, for the record, that fraud is not the same as misuse, and misuse is not the same as waste, and fraud is intentional criminal action, mm-hmm. and we all want to stop that from happening and to go after the people who are committing that against the state and the taxpayers. The ballpark number to start up the Department of Children, Youth, and Families was about $27.5 million over a couple of different years. And so I think that, you know, just to leave it at this, we support this notion. I've already had some initial conversation with Representative Norris, but at this point, just given the conversation today, and it seems like we do have a lot of work to do, my concerns are that this proposal doesn't yet comply with the federal rules and regulations governing CCAP, and I don't think it's ready to move forward. So I'll be voting no today, but I do know, again, that you have other committee stops and that you'll be actually returning to government, state government, for a second time. So I also will ask that the chair consider potentially bringing it back to Children and Families again in the future. But I, again, appreciate your hard work on this, and it's not an easy task, and I look forward to continued conversation.
Thank you.
And I have a few closing comments before we let you wrap up your bill. But, you know, Republicans have beaten the fraud drum for quite some time. You know, we've been pointing out that maybe state government doesn't spend your money the wisest, yes, but also what we're seeing is the oversight is lax at best. And it is such a massive problem, over $500 million now. And when you look at that and you compare it to some of the concerns that were brought up today, which are almost entirely valid, nobody here wants to see a loss of federal funds, but everybody here wants to see fraud rooted out. And one important thing of this bill, and I've actually talked significantly with inspector generals who have both worked currently and formerly worked for the state of Minnesota, mm-hmm. talked to the National Association, just like Representative Anderson here. And what they've seen in the fraud that happens here is we have a culture in our executive branch that is partnering and taking an excessively collaborative approach when we're allocating dollars that need to be judiciously spent. The Office of the Legislative Auditor made a specific finding of this in their report, that rather than looking skeptically at people after government dollars, they're looking at how they can get them even more government dollars. And that's where we've seen us get off the path. It's been a while since the Republicans held the executive branch, and one factor of that is now the department views all these different allocation of funds as something they're supposed to increase and maximize rather than oversee and be judicious with who gets what money and how much. And we have to have that approach. Our legal system's adversarial. Our grant system, and the way government disperses money, maybe not adversarial, but it should be skeptical for sure. And the most important aspect of House File 1 is moving it into the legislature. What we've seen is when the legislative auditor goes after something, it is generally smart, and it doesn't necessarily make one party happy and the other not. When they go after charter schools, Republicans are like, well, these charter schools, blah, blah, blah. When they look at CCAP fraud, when they look at these other aspects, we might see something else from the other side of the aisle. Leaving it in the executive creates a very difficult situation for these inspector generals, and I've heard from them specifically, is, well, they're appointed by the governor, they're responsible to the commissioner, deputy commissioner, and there's a lot of pressure, particularly when they do have to do a politically sensitive investigation. And when you're dispersing a lot of money, it's automatically politically sensitive because it's embarrassing to have a lot of money lost to fraud. In the legislative branch, we don't have that problem. We might have a squirrely member here, a squirrely member there, but the fact that the audit commission is the one that governs this means neither party has an advantage, and this will be way more diligent in going after fraud without political pressures that I know inspector generals have seen. So this is an important bill. I think we had a very productive discussion here today. There's more work to be done, and we're excited to do the work. And I love my committee because, you see, you come here and you have a bunch of terrific questions. Representative Perez-Rego, Representative Coulter, Representative Hicks all had very good input. And I feel bad now that I only listed a couple. But see, it was actually a productive time, and that's what we want to cultivate here. But what I want to hammer home is this bill is important because we've seen a loss of skepticism when dispersing state funds. That is not good. That is very bad. And the way we can improve it is by moving it into the legislative branch, because we have hard evidence that when we oversee something, it's a lot more diligent at going after its objective, and it's less subject to political pressures because it faces pressures of both parties, as it should. So thank you for bringing this bill forward. It was a nice, arduous journey. You are welcome to close it out.
Thank you, and I'll be, I know there's another bill up, so I'll be really brief. So thank you, and Representative West, you hit the nail on the head. A lot of the problem, you would not be solving anything if you just consolidated this and left it in the executive branch. It has to be independent, and I'm not making a judgment about the existing executive, or I don't want to go there because I want this to be not like that and nonpartisan and everything. But you have to have independence. This entity has to have an independence, and we have it's worked. The legislative auditor, and that's, again, that's financial, and they answer to us as legislators. That has worked for decades, and it is not partisan. There's been no controversy, and so we know it works, and this will be the same. This will work if we bring it under the legislative branch, and it's important. So I thank you again. Good insight. I've got my notes, Representative Hicks and Coulter, to get back to you when we get to this final, and I appreciate all your discussion. So thank you. I'm off to the Senate for our meeting. I'll tell them what happened here. So,
well, we haven't voted yet. I'll renew my motion.
Empty vote, yeah.
My motion to re-refer House File 1 to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Now the moment we have all been waiting for. The first bill from Chair Katiza Witoon.
Oh, did you hear it?
They switched the chair on you. Good to see you all the way over there. I'm sure you would love to move your own bill, and go ahead and get started.
I would. Mr. Chair, I would move that House.
Come on.
Thank you.
Come on. Yeah. Come on. I have my own. Go ahead, Chair Katiza-Witoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 1384 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. So with that, I want to bring forward the Great Start Child Care Tax Credit. This was originally introduced back in 2021. I worked with then Representative and Chair of the Tax Committee, Paul Marquardt. He is now the Commissioner of Revenue, and he was very helpful in crafting a bill that I think would expand our existing dependent care credit. right now, you don't get any additional funds for children who are under the ages six and under. And as we know, there are much higher costs of having children who are pre-kindergarten years simply because of the need for childcare in most situations. You know, if families aren't able to stay home and take care of their kids, then they're looking for a safe and reliable childcare provider. So this bill, it is a pretty simple bill, and basically it just expands, number one, the number of children who can qualify for the child care credit, but then also the amounts. And so currently $3,000 for one qualifying individual, but you add $7,000 if it's a young child, so it'll be up to $10,000. If it's right now, you can qualify for $6,000 for two or more qualifying individuals, that's children or dependents. But so you would add $14,000 if there are two young children under the age of six, and add $19,000 if there are three or more. So basically, if people are having larger families, we are expanding it so that they can qualify for a third child, and then expanding the amount. It is income adjusted, so it phases down after $125,000 of earned household income, and then it covers at the lowest point at over $400,000. Excuse me, it goes down to zero. So many families in Minnesota will be able to qualify for this that don't currently qualify for either our scholarships program or the child care assistance program or some of the other. Our nation-leading child tax credit that doesn't specifically cover the cost of child care. With that, I know we're running short on time, so I do have a testifier and then want to leave a little bit of time for questions.
All righty. Ms. Sanford, will you sprint up here? There we go. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. And this is a great committee. I love the vibe of this committee. I am Claire Sanford. I chair government relations on the board of the Minnesota Child Care Association, which is a statewide nonprofit association representing licensed child care centers. And we're here in support of this bill. Everyone here knows the importance of child care for workforce participation and for the education and care of young children. And family affordability is a top agenda item for MCCA. Well, there are certainly areas of the state that physically need more child care supply to be created. A child care crisis still exists across the state with underutilized supply, and the majority of our members have continuous stories about how they are not fully enrolled, and not for lack of demand. They consistently have families who want their services, but the families do not have the resources to afford those services. So we actually have a lot of child care capacity in Minnesota that is sitting unused right now because families can't access it. We wholeheartedly believe that child care needs to be made cheaper for families. At the same time, providers need more resources in order to continue advancing compensation and attracting and retaining qualified educators. We like the part of this bill that really focuses on children under five. It is aimed at boosting help for families when they're feeling the most pain, those with children under five. Certainly financial pain. I know some members have new members of the family. There's other pain that comes along with very young children, but financial for childcare is certainly one of them. And the early childhood years are the most expensive for childcare, and with good reason. We need low adult-child ratios to drive child safety and healthy development and learning, but we ask the most of families when they have the least. Families with young children are typically early in their earning cycle. They don't have as much to give. They don't have as much support. So increasing the credits for kids under five really recognizes that. And in addition, the main thing, I think, for this, not only the focus on young children, but the main thrust here is expanding this help up the income scale for families. We have done a lot for low-income families in regards to child care expenses over the last several years, and no doubt more needs to be done there. We're not done. But middle-class families have gotten just about nothing in terms of help. And we can't keep looking at helping families with child care expenses as only something we do for low-income families. It's too big of an economic and an educational problem. And we're talking about tax credits today. I know other members of this committee have tax bills aimed at the affordability problem. Some members have direct subsidy bills aimed at the affordability problem. We just so appreciate the highlight on family affordability and want to keep the conversation going. Let's debate all the proposals. Let's get the merits on the table. And most importantly, let's get something positive done for Minnesota families. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sanford. Always good to hear from you. Member questions. Any members of the committee have any questions for the bill? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Khatija Watoon. I'm super happy with your bill. I do have some questions. Can you explain to me, I'm having a hard time determining on lines 4.3 to 4.11, that is an employment-related expense incurred that has the credits versus lines 4.14 to 4.23, where it is it has different limits. Can you explain the differences there for me? I'm sorry, I'm just not following this.
Representative Khatija Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nadeau. Yes, that change is actually the point of this entire proposal. We've termed it the Great Start Child Care Tax Credit and Dependent Care Credit, because the Dependent Care Credit is actually what's currently in state law. And so we have decided to target at the youngest Minnesotans, particularly to support with child care costs. So up through the age of six, and below, I recognize that there are expanded costs for folks who have other dependents who don't fall in that age range, but this bill is specifically to target the cost of child care for our youngest Minnesotans.
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And so for a family that has, just let's just say they have one child, age five, what are they capped at? Is it 3 or 7? What's the credit cap?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The idea is that the existing limit is $3,000, and we would want to add $7,000 to that. So we want it to be a $10,000 credit for a family with one child under the age of six.
Representative Nadeau.
Okay. Thank you. I know this is similar to House File 9 from last year. And did you have, I'm just curious as to what you anticipate the fiscal note on this to be.
Representative Khatija Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have the fiscal note with me from 2022. And it is about $200 million a year. It's a costly proposal. But there's a lot of families with children who need that support.
Representative Nadeau.
And just one final question. So we did make some changes to the dependent care credit last year. And I think that fiscal note might have included that. So maybe this will go further than that. There were some slight, I think there was roughly a $50 million care credit that was added last year, so maybe it would go further than that. I'm not really sure. Do you have any comments on that?
Chair Khatija Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did introduce this proposal again in 2022. That was House File 9, and we ended up moving forward with just a general expanded child tax credits that wasn't specific to work-related child care expenses or dependent care expenses. And we have the, I'm really proud of it, we have the best child care or child tax credit in the nation. But I think that in addition, and that was very specifically targeted toward our lowest income Minnesotans, and we have improved it even since it was passed in 2022, where now the Department of Revenue has actually been able to begin advance payments. And that was something that we talked about with Commissioner Marquardt back in 2021 about how we would love to get moving and get the money out the door to families as fast as possible so that they didn't have to wait until April, May, you know, whenever they get their tax return back. So now the department has actually found a way to do that, and that is something that when we head over to the tax committee, I want to take that conversation forward and see if we can make that work for this proposal as well. So I would love to see it continue on.
Representative Nolan. Yes, this is a very good bill. Particularly, I like expanding the income because, you know, just with a second kid, once I send her to daycare, it's $4,000 a month. It's like, well, that is ridiculous. And one frustration when the majority passed the massive expansion of the child tax credit, it's like, okay, there was just targeted to very narrow band of people who also need help, but if we want people to have families, if we want people to grow families, they need the ability to do so, and this helps with that tremendously. But we are well out of time, so I'll let you wrap up your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would renew my motion that House File 1384 be referred to the Committee on Taxes so we can continue this conversation. We know and we will continue to hear proposals that would impact Minnesota's children and families in extraordinarily positive ways, and we're going to have to get creative with the money on how to get there. So appreciate the support for this and look forward to continuing conversations.
If anybody has $200 million on them, let us know. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is on its way to taxes. All right. Well, we'll see you all next week or tomorrow. Committee's adjourned.